Okay, sorry. Well, hi, everybody. We're going to get started. Sorry for the delay. I'm Tim Marzullo. I am a recently finishing postdoc here at UM. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about neurophysiology today. I understand Chris went into the mechanics of ion transport, so we're going to dive right into you have brain, how do you record brain? So the neuroscience is the kind of field that typically sells itself. I don't have to get up here and tell you that the brain is interesting. All of humanity is naturally curious in it. But as tradition shows, we should open with something showing how amazing the human brain is with one round of 10 juggling balls, which I think robotics can do two or three now. But the coordination between eye and hand to catch it is pretty cool. So the Buzaki chapter, for my section of this course, I assigned a Buzaki chapter, which is a good intro to various recording technologies and also data analysis routines. And if you just want to learn some basic brain physiology, I recommend reading the human physiology textbook you all purchased at your own leisure. But we're going to dive right down into actually how do you record brain signals. So one way you can record brain signals in humans is via EEG recordings, which is called electroencephalograms. You see a little baby with about 50 electrodes on there, and what they're doing is recording the voltage across the surface of the brain. Another way is through MEG, or magnetoelectroencephalography, and you're recording the magnetic fields caused by current moving across the membranes. This method, EEG, is typically very low signal-noise ratio. It takes sophisticated amplifiers and sophisticated scientists to get meaningful signal out of it. An alternative way is called the electrocorticogram, which is called the ECOG, which is where you open the skull, remove the bone, and you see a strip of electrode contacts on the surface of the brain. And there's the X-ray image of the electrodes on the brain. Now, I said that the EEG is typically a low signal noise ratio, but if I put a single EEG electrode on this on your forehead or scalp and then appropriately grounded it and walked into the adjacent room, I could tell a number of things. I could tell, for one, if you're awake or doing something, which is exemplified by this kind of low amplitude, high frequency components on the top. I can tell if you're quietly relaxing, which is the alpha rhythms on the second. Drowsy, and all the way to deep sleep. When you're sleeping, your brain kind of goes into an oscillatory mode dominated by 1 to 3 hertz oscillations there. Now, there's another component to neuroscience, which I'm not going to spend that much time on, but when I first was an undergraduate, I joined a lab doing peripheral nervous system recordings. And what you can see here is I have exposed the sciatic nerve, which is this white nerve right here, and I'm recording the gross compound action potential on a vintage Tektronix oscilloscope here. But if you're like me, you're interested in the brain. You want to learn how to record from it, how to understand it. Can anybody guess what animal this is? I hear murmurings, but I don't hear any species. There you go. It's a rat brain. One of the ways you can tell is that there's no folds in the cortex. Humans, monkeys, dogs, cats have folds consisting of gyri and sulci to increase the surface area of the cortex, which is the part of the brain responsible for all that we like doing, reading, writing, dancing, singing. You can see here's the cortex right here, the cerebellum in the back here, which is responsible for motor coordination. And one of the first discoveries I made in grad school is this is one of the rats I implanted. I remember training him on a task. And for some reason, this rat just wouldn't learn the task. He was trained to put his nose in an aperture for a length of time. And normal rats could do it for about 4 or 5 seconds. And this rat could never hold his nose for more than a second. He seemed to show very anxious behavior. But he had wonderful recording quality, so I spent months and months training this guy in the hopes that I would get good data out of him. And finally, I just got so frustrated, I said, well, something's got to be going on here. And so I euthanized the animal and extracted the brain, and you can see that compared to the previous one, Now, the one difference is that this is fixed, so that's why you don't see any blood. But you can see that there's a massive infection over on one entire half of the brain. Now, the electrode was over here in healthy tissue, so that's why I was able to get good units. But I was really excited because for the first time I had proven that the brain is responsible for behavior. Okay, so we're going to talk mostly about rat work. That's what I do and show the real data for that. But to compare, here's a human brain inside all y'all's skulls. When I say there's sulci and gyri, you can see all the folds here, all divided into functional subregions, which all do many wonderful things that you can read about in your textbook. And you can see the cerebellum here, the deep brain, the midbrain, and then the ventricles right here. And this is the rat brain. You can see the same cerebellum, and the cortex is relatively smaller in comparison. And then here is the midbrain and deep brain. Okay, what is the basic structure of the cortex? What we have here is a cross-section of the neocortex, which is the wrinkly part of the brain on the top, and also, in, according in the rat, this part up here. We take a cross-section and stain it with a different variety of staining methods. The one on the left is called a Golgi stain. I don't know if some of you are familiar with it. One of the first Nobel Prizes in physiology was awarded to Golgi for inventing this silver impregnation method, which, for reasons still unknown, you inject this sort of dye and transform it with reagents. And this dye fills only a small subset of neurons in the brain. So you can see very nice structure, because if you stained every single cell in the brain, you would see just dark. So you only want to selectively stain cells. And you see here are the cell bodies, then the dendrites, then the nice arborizations. And so if you stain all the cell bodies with a different type of stain, you see all these punctates, and there's different types of cell populations in different layers. The neocortex is typically referred to as a six-layered structure. And so you have the cell bodies, these are the entire neurons, and then if you do a special stain to stain only for the myelin, which is what coats the axons of a million neurons, you can see that there's all these complicated connections that go across layers and within layers. We still are trying to figure out what it all does and how it does it. Now here's some real staining. These are different parts of the brain. This is the visual cortex. And this is the motor cortex. The visual cortex is in the back of the brain, right around here, and it's responsible for perceiving vision. And it gets multiple inputs from the thalamus, so you can see this dark band that you can even see with the naked eye when you're doing brain slicing. These are all the inputs coming from the thalamus, which is the gateway of the brain. Light goes from the retina, the optic nerve, to the thalamus, to the cortex, and then all over the brain. What allows us to do things like pay attention. And then here's the motor cortex. The motor cortex has very special cells called pyramidal cells that are quite easy to record from because they're so big. They have these huge cell bodies right here in layer 5 and 6. And they have huge cell bodies, and you also have axons that go all the way to your spinal cord. It's the longest cells in the human body. The soma, or cell body, of the neuron begins at the top of your brain in the neocortex, travels all the way down the brainstem to, you can imagine, the one that's controlling your foot, terminates at the bottom of your spinal cord. And the reason it's so easy to record from is because it has a huge dipole field. It has a huge soma, and if you look on the previous Golgi impregnation slides, it has an axon process going all the way up to layer 2 and 1. So you have current flow, a dipole field going from the dendrites all the way down to the soma, which makes it easy to record. If we go to other cell types, like these granule cells, which look like this right here, they have very small dipole fields because of the distance between the sources and sinks of the current. So what you can see here, again, is it's very easy to show how complicated and wonderful the brain is. You can see in the cortex alone, all these various geometries and cell types. You have the spiny stellate, which are the layer 4 input neurons, and the huge pyramidal neurons and motor cortex I was referring to earlier. You can see these axon processes also extend up to 3 millimeters away. And this is typically the go-to circuitry diagram. Typically, neuron signals come in through layer 4 of the cortex, go up to the upper layers, then back down to the lower layers to go to the other brain areas or down to the spinal cord, if you consider the brain is something that transforms inputs via your senses to outputs via your motor behavior. That's simplistic. It's one way of thinking about it. But to make that more sense, inputs come through here, they go up, do their nice thing, come down. That's how the brain works. So we're all engineers, and we actually want to record brain signals. The technology of chronic recording of brain signals began in 1957 with David Hubel, who was recording from the visual cortex of cats using tungsten microwire arrays. Microwire arrays are what you think they are. They are small diameter wires that extend. These are handmade usually in a laboratory. If any of you want to join a neuroscience lab, one of your first jobs may be to sit at a bench for hours and build these things. So you can see that there are these grids of about 6 to 10 or 60 wires. You remove part of the bone and you stick it in, wait a couple weeks and see what if you can isolate any single neurons. This is work done in Daryl Kipke's lab. You can see a larger view with a surrounding bone, brain on the inside, and then here it looks like there's 8 wires going into the cortex of the brain. But we're at Michigan. We want to show pride in what we do. The University of Michigan is famous for so-called Michigan probes, which uses MEMS-based technology to print electrodes. And so you can see, some of you probably with more EECS experience than me know about this process in much more detail, but you use silicon dioxide substrates and actually print electrode sites all along the shanks of the electrode array. And here is the fabrication process you can see right here. So this is what the probes that people typically record from around here look like. This is the truss on an American penny. And you can see right there at the bottom of the S, these very fine featured electrodes with multiple sites to record from and also holes where you can put drugs of interest. And then what you do is you then can stick multiple electrode arrays into the brain of rats. You can see here there's a long flexible ribbon cable that then goes into the brain here, which is then covered with a siloastic gel, and then also some gel foam, and you coat the whole thing in acrylic. Some chronic versions. You can also do recordings in a brain slice. If you take an embryonic rat pup about 5 or 6 days after it's born, cut its head off and extract its brain. I don't do this work because I think it's gross. You slice a little bit of the brain about 1 millimeter thick, and you can keep it alive for about 3 hours, and you can see about 16 shangs nicely penetrating the brain and hopefully recording from it. You can also have multiple shanks going in. That's a 3D array. Then we can have ECOG arrays, which are small versions that record from the surface, which we can then combine with depth electrodes. Have you guys seen any gross things yet in this class? It's all schematized. Maybe I should have drawn a picture. Okay, so you want to record brain signals. There are many different types you can record. One is, as I've shown before with the picture of the baby, you can stick scalp electrodes on the surface of the skin and record signals from a large area, centimeters of brain, which you're typically recording synchronous currents in the brain. It's not very specific, and it's low signal-to-noise ratio. You can remove the bone, and you can put metal contacts on the surface of the brain, and this is called the electrocorticogram. You're still recording from simultaneous populations summed postsynaptic potentials, to be precise, but still it's not very specific. You're only recording from large populations of nervous system tissue. Now, if you want to record up to a millimeters away, then you can stick an electrode in the brain, and what you can record from this are field potentials or single units. Now, if you have a wire, if you have scissors, and you hook it up to your amplifier and stick it into your brain, you're going to record a multitude of signals from a multiple of brain sources. So, of course, you can record single units, which are the discharge, electrical discharge of single neurons, if you're lucky and your electrode is small enough. That's done by high-passing the signal coming through the electrodes around 1,000 hertz. You can also low-pass it between 3 and 90 hertz, and you get field potentials. Field potentials are similar to the EEGs and ECOGs. The ECOGs and EEGs can be considered summed field potentials. What exactly field potentials are is a huge subject of debate. If you want a career in neuroscience, you can try to understand this. But generally, the field potentials consist of, if you recall from Chris's lecture, that when you have neurons synapsing on postsynaptic neurons, neurotransmitter crosses the synaptic cleft, synaptic chasm. A neurotransmitter, be it glutamate or GABA or acetylcholine or nitrous oxide, then binds to receptors in the synapse and causes an inward current flow. This is how action potentials and spikes propagate through the brain. It originates in the dendrites, travels to the soma, to the axons then synapse on other dendrites. But there is a space in between each cell called the synapse. And so when you have glutamate, for example, right here, and it binds to a receptor in the synapse, it binds and it allows sodium to flow in. It flows in with a time course of around 10 milliseconds. You get enough of these happening simultaneously, you get an effect of population average, which is what the local field potential is. Now, spikes are the individual discharges traveling down the axons. And after break, we'll get to see some here in the little box there. And also, what you can do, if you want really high signal noise ratio, you have anesthetized animal, or you have the brain removed, or you're recording from oocytes or zebrafish, you can stick an electrode right on the cell body. You have to do this under a microscope. What you do is you grind some very fine glass. Some of the older professors at this university can tell you how they spend hours grinding glass to get the really sharp electrode. You have a sharp tip glass pipette filled with saline with a wire inside of it. And under a microscope, you then patch the cell body of the neuron. And as you can imagine, this is a very high signal to noise ratio. It looks like there's barely any noise. It looks like a solid line on the trace. So you can record the membrane potential, and this is what all the stuff you found about in the last lecture was done. It was done using squid giant axons and this whole cell recording method. Now, if that's even too crude for you, if you want something even more specific than whole cell recordings, you can grind the electrode down even finer, latch on to a patch of membrane, but do not penetrate the cell, then you, with negative pressure, then lift back, and you'll have a little piece of membrane with a couple ion channels in it. You can do some very nice kinetics and extreme small-scale neurophysiology. We're looking at quantum currents. The game I dwell in is in the LFP, Spike, and EcoG world. So, as I've said before, you wake up tomorrow and you want to do your own neural recordings. I do. You stick a nail into the brain, conductive wire, and then you high-pass filter it, You're recording the spike transients coming up the neuron, in the electrode. You high pass it. What you see is here's your noise floor, because again, you're doing extracellular recording. The source of your currents are far away from your recording electrode. If this was single cell recording, you would see a solid line with the voltage transients of the active potential of the spikes. And you zoom in on the spikes, and here's what it looks like. Playing with your oscilloscope, this is what the average waveform looks like. Now, this may look different from the traces in your textbook or when Chris showed you, but most of the traces you see in your textbook and when they're showing the mechanics of the action potential are done using intracellular recording. The shape of this is really strongly dependent on the anatomy of the neuron and the dipole field it's generating. So that's why it doesn't look exactly like the classic action potential with the rise, fall, on refractory period. But it's still good enough to do science. So you put a bunch of electrodes in the brain, wait a couple weeks. In this data I'm showing here, I am putting a single shank multi-site electrode in the cortex, and you can see I'm spanning all the layers, and all of the data I'm showing you here, this consisted of multi-site single shank electrodes going into the brain. You wait for the rat to recover, and here he is looking very ready. So, you know, he's got this stuff coming out of his head, but it doesn't appear behaviorally to bother him. He still does his rat thing, exploring the cage. See, I've opened the door, and he's coming out looking at me. This is a typical chronic recording setup if you're using cats or rats or mice or monkeys. What you have here, and yes, I have thought of wireless, you have some cables coming up to a commentator, which consists of brushes that spin, so this doesn't get tangled, and then comes out of the commentator to the amplifiers to record the microvolt currents that are generated by the extracellular spikes. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you can get an extracellular spike on the order of 300 microvolts. Most often, it's on the order of 80 to 100 microvolts. So, like I said before, you high-pass the electrical signals to record the spikes. You low-pass it to get the field potentials, which are the summed postsynaptic potentials I showed on the board. You can see there's a lot of stuff going on. To the untrained eye, it just looks like noise. Certainly did to me when I first started learning how to do neuroscience. But what you can see are these fast transients combined with these sort of slow oscillations. These fast transients, does anybody venture as to what these things are? There's a slow oscillation. There's really fast transients. They are sodium influx, part of it, since these are extracellular. You can't, you know, for sure determine. But, yes, these fast transients are the sodium influx caused by the action potential. And then, you know, the down phase is caused by the potassium outflux. And these slow rhythms right here are the field potentials, which I explained before. There again is an enlarged version of these transient spikes, which are the discharges of single neurons. So you do your first experiment in neuroscience. You plug in your animal. And what does it look like? So we can, the upper traces are going to be the field potentials. This is an anesthetized rat immediately after surgery. What you can see on the lower traces are a series of lines. These are the high-pass versions of the channels with ticks. The ticks are reducing the dimensionality of the spikes. Every time a spike happens, you can represent it as just a single slash. This is called a raster. In the next lecture on Wednesday, we'll go a little bit in more detail into analysis methods of a neural recording data. So, word on the street is that there is not a Let's see if we can hear it. It's not very loud, but hear that kind of popcorn sound? That is the spiking of individual neurons. I had it backwards. The little ticks on the top are when spikes occurred on the various channels recorded through the multi-electrode array, and the traces on the bottom are the field potentials of the same channels. Now, you can record more than one single unit per channel. That's why you see approximately 8 traces here, and it looks like 16 over here. Yes. That's what it's thought to be. It's thought to be the summed average of excitatory potentials, which means it's the summed average of glutamate binding to the synapses and causing sodium influx in dendrites. And if it's all happening at the same time, then that's the field potential. The top is the spikes. So like I showed you before on the, this. So this is a spike or an extracellular recorded action potential. If we simply take this, right, so this is when you're doing neural coding analysis, say I stick a wire in the brain, right? Wire, brain. Right, so like I said, the field potential may be this kind of low frequency oscillatory thing. And then you have these, these action potentials. Right. These are invariant, right? There's a lot of evolving information in here in the time and frequency domain. But really, when you're talking about spikes, since they're all or none, they happen once a neuron has reached threshold. And then the typical spike will be discharged by the neuron as the discharge travels down the axon. Don't you think, perhaps, to make it simpler, can we just represent it like this? Right? To make it even simpler, if we're coding away in MATLAB, can we just do this? 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1. And then you can do all your fancy analysis routines trying to determine what features of a neural recording correlate with whatever behavior you seem to be studying. So when you asked what's on the top, you're looking at this. Everybody understand? Stop me if I'm going too fast. I've studied this for 8 years. It's all easy for me. Not true. Okay. So like I said before, if you noticed, there were multiple traces on the top. Now you're recording the field potential and the spike from the same electrode channel. How is it that I can record, well, there are more traces here than there are traces here? If a field potential and a spike, these are called rasters, are recorded from the same channel. How do we have more rasters than field potentials? Because you can record, if you're lucky, in your experiments, multiple single units per electrode. So if we go back to our little friend nail and brain over here, you can see. We zoom in. Here's our little electrode with the uninsulated tip. not drawn to scale. Do a little bit. The closer, of course, the closer your neuron is to the recording site tip, the higher the amplitude of the spike's going to be. So here you can see right here, it's very high amplitude. This is all these boxes here are single channels on a multi-electrode array. So you see there are approximately 32 channels, right? And all these colors consist of isolated single units or multi-unit activity. We'll go into how you can tell whether they're multi-units or single units when you're doing recording in the next lecture, but you can see that this very tight cluster of an invariant waveform is a high amplitude, most likely from a single neuron here. But there are approximately 10,000 neurons per cubic millimeter of neural tissue. So you can see that your neuron should be able to record from many neurons. In the real world, you can record from a few, not many. Most often you record from one. Or in this case, I'm seeing each color corresponds to what I thought was a different neuron. You can see there's about three different neural clusters there. Now, this high amplitude one is most likely a single unit, but the smaller ones here are most likely summed discharge from a population of neurons. This is called multi-unit activity in our field. Now, like I said before, in one of my first experiments, I discovered that the brain is responsible for behavior. That means that depending on what part of the brain you're in, it's going to be responsive to certain features of the external world, or it's going to be controlling movements or influencing your mood. So what I have here is a recording from a part of the brain responsible for movement, and you can see that when the rat makes a right-hand turn with its neck, the discharge rate of the neuron decreases. Let's see. Notice how the discharge rate decreases as the rat moves to the right. Okay, so, like I said before, you can, once you're done isolating these single units, you can, if you're recording from a human, it's usually in a clinical setting, always is actually, unless you're doing motor units of the bicep. This is an experiment where I recorded from the front of the brain and the back of the brain, more specifically the motor cortex, which, can anyone tell me what you think that's responsible for? Movement. It was the first part of the brain to be discovered via electrical stimulation, which is what we'll talk about next lecture. In the 1880s, two German scientists did an experiment with their dog on their kitchen table, anesthetized the dog, opened up the skull, and applied stimulating current and saw evoked movements. And they saw different types of evoked movements depending on where they placed their probe. The first part of the brain to be discovered actually doing a single thing was around the Civil War time by Paul Broca. Some of you have probably heard of Broca's area in the popular science press. Does anybody know what that part of the brain does? Yep, it is very good. It is responsible for the production of speech. There's a continuing oscillation in neuroscience. Is the brain organized into functional discrete modules, much like your motherboard? If you go through the scientific literature throughout antiquity, the brain is always being compared to the current state of the art of technology. So if you like computers, you like to think of the brain as a computer. If you like steam engines, you like to think of it as steam engines if you happen to be living in the 19th century. If you're an engineer at UM in the 50s, you think of the brain as elaborate telephone system networks. Anyway. Broca's area. So the debate throughout the ages of neuroscience is whether the brain is this holistic kind of thing, that the brain as a sum is responsible for behavior, or is it divided into functional regions. It takes its modern form in fMRI, which is where you put a human in the scanner and you can see the level of blood oxygenation of the tissue surrounding a neuron. But the Broca's area was actually discovered by a skeptic. He was one of the holistic, he was in the holistic camp that the brain is this wonderful thing that as a whole creates behavior. But he was a physician, and this woman came into his clinic and her speech was unintelligible. She died a few days to weeks later. They did a postmortem analysis, looked at the brain. The brain looked relatively healthy, except for a little lesion right there. And he named it, I don't know what he named it, but it's now called Broca's area for that discovery. And so that was the first discovery of functional localization of the brain. Functional localization does exist. How specific it is a matter of continuing research and refinement. But we can say that there are parts of the brain that are responsible for processing vision. There are parts of the brain responsible for processing movement. That's not a very controversial statement. So I implanted rats with electrodes in the motor cortex and the visual cortex. And while the rat was anesthetized, I then flashed the lights in his cage on and off for 2 seconds every 20 seconds. And so what you're seeing here, typically in the parlance of neural signal recordings, you transform the discharge of neurons of single units into a rate. So if we go here, say we're sampling at certain time bins, this is in 10 milliseconds, we have one spike in 10 milliseconds, we divide by 0.10, and that equals, if I was teaching a biology class, I would expect blank state faces 100. Very good. Future of America. 100 hertz. So neurons, because of the absolute and refractory period, have a maximum frequency of 200 hertz. That's what it says in your textbooks. That's what professors will tell you. Sometimes, if you're doing neuroscience experiments, you might see one phi or higher, but you can generally assume that the highest, via the kinetics of the ion channels in a refractory period, the highest a neuron can fire is about 200 hertz. So what we have here is on the y-axis the firing rate of the neuron in hertz, or cycles per second. And over here we have time. At time zero is when light was flashed. These are histology images of the various parts of the brain. We don't need to pay attention to that. Rest assured, different parts of the brain area. Brain, they look different. But these are three different rats. In the upper two, you see motor cortex, and in the bottom, you see visual cortex. Can anybody tell me what we see when we flash lights on in the different brain areas? I'm sorry? We see something. What we see is an increased discharge of the action potentials, an increase in frequency. The hertz increases. So you can see that when I flashed the light on in the visual cortex, you had a transient, brief increase in the firing rate. You could argue that then this neuron is encoding the light source, or it's receptive to the light source. These are all three different visual cortex implants, and you can see the same thing. There is a response to light onset, and in some neurons, light offset. Now, if we go to the motor cortex, we do not see it. We see some subtle things, which is not surprising. The brain is one huge interconnected network. You would be surprised if you did not see an effect of light in the motor cortex, because parts of the visual cortex project to the motor cortex. You can imagine such a situation, kind of startle responses, but that typically occurs in the lower brain areas. So you can see that there is much subtler modulation. So what we've discovered here is that, again, different parts of the brain do different things, and this is called rate coding. It was one of the first neural codes to be discovered, that as the intensity, if we have stimulus intensity on the y-axis, frequency of discharge on the x-axis. What do you think is going to happen as I increase stimulus? Wait, that's bad. Let's make it easier. As the stimulus increases, what's going to happen to the frequency? I don't hear very well. I don't have good rate coding in my cochlea. It will increase. I ask easy questions. Now, since we're dealing with a biological system, do people think it'll be linear? That as you keep increasing the stimulus, the firing rate's going to keep increasing like this? What's going to happen? It's going to plateau. It's going to saturate. So often, you often see this also, with the binding of oxygen to hemoglobin. It's a sigmoidal transfer function, that there's a sweet spot in the stimulus where the rate of discharge increases and then plateaus. And depending on what kind of neuron it is, it could also do the opposite. It could decrease, and also it can shift. If you can imagine a set of neurons with overlapping representations, with enough neurons, you can basically reconstruct any stimulus you give to it. A common experiment is in neuroscience is to record from as many neurons as possible in a behavioral experiment under as many different variations of stimulus intensity and see if you can then predict, based on the frequency, what the stimulus is going to be as we struggle to understand this. And with that, I'm going to go into some more recordings, but let's try to see some real neuroscience. I want to set up an experiment here. Let's take a 5 to 10 minute break, and then we'll get to see some cockroaches. All right, we'll get started. All right. Well, we have our friends, the humble cockroach over there, a couple of them. You all can play with them after class if you like. They're 340 million years old, evolutionarily speaking, yet they still have nervous systems. We want to treat all God's creatures humanely, so they're invertebrates. What do invertebrates are not? They're not much like us. Name some ways they're not like us. I'm sorry, what? They have no backbone. That's right. They have an exoskeleton. Anything else? I'm a biologist by training. I like this kind of stuff. What else is different from an invertebrate and a vertebrate? Yes, their circulatory system is very different. They don't have lungs. If you cut off a cockroach's head, it can still live about 3 weeks because they just have hollow tubes in their bodies that can allow oxygen to diffuse. That's why, in the experiment I'm going to show you, I can remove its leg and we can record for up to 18 hours from this leg. What else? What am I doing right now with cockroaches? You people in the front can see. What's going on? Explain to the class what is going on.
They're on ice right now.
They're on ice. Why are they on ice? To anesthetize, and they're cold-blooded. So they're just going to stop moving, and then I can cut off their legs, and they'll be okay. And they grow back as long as it's still in nymph. If it's an adult, then they don't grow back. But the ones we'll do experiments on today are nymphs. So the cockroach will be better for it. While we're waiting on them to chill out, we'll proceed. We're going to proceed with some more basic neuroscience, and then we'll close the class with an experiment. Let's hope it works. Okay, like I said, someone named the four electrode signals you can record in the brain. You can name five or six if you want to. This may be important. New generation needs the notes right in front of them. Magnetic. Magnetoencephalography, that's one. That's another one. I'm sorry? I didn't hear. That's right, EEG, that's another one. You guys are thinking humans. What can we do if we stick electrodes in the brain? What can we record? Stick electrodes in that cockroach, what can we record? That's right. Electric fields. Everything we're talking about right here is electric fields. Whether it's single unit recording, which is one cell. And multi-unit recording, which I'm not going to humor you and ask what that is. All right, and then what was I talking about over here with the summed synaptic potentials? Local field potentials. So in one prep here, we can record about three of the signals. Right here is the ECOG probe. This is not as sophisticated as some of you who may work in a clinic have seen, with sheets with metal contacts in them. These are simply screws set into the rat's skull with insulated wire coming off of them that then terminates in the head cap, and we can record the electrocorticogram, which is basically the field potential on the surface of the brain. You can't see it in this blurry image. You can kind of see it, but I have my chronic electrode going into a craniotomy and into the brain. With that, I can record my single unit activity, my multi-unit activity, and my field potentials. What do they all look like if we record them at the same time? So over here, we have the rasters. What does this raster mean? A single spike occurred at this moment in time. We were looking at 9 seconds. Now, I said earlier that you can represent spikes as the binary code. You cannot do it with the field potentials. Why do you think that is? It's not an all-or-none event. It is graded. It is evolving. So you cannot represent it as strictly zeros and ones. One way you can treat this, and most often the processes, that simple analog signal analysis that you may learn in some of your other classes. I never knew when I decided to study the brain that it would involve so much electrical engineering. But neuroscience is effectively electrical engineering if you're doing neural recording. If you're doing pure behavior, then it's psychology. And so this is a simple signal because the rat's anesthetized, so you're just getting the slow brain rhythms. But this is a signal evolving in amplitude and frequency and time. And so if you have a signal evolving in frequency, how can you deconstruct it if you have a signal? Fourier analysis, you can do that. I'm sorry? Do that as well. Everybody does these things in neuroscience. So if we want to look at the relationship between spikes and field potentials, they're both field potentials and spikes are caused by nervous system tissue. Anything that generates a current or a voltage change in your brain is going to contribute to what you see when you stick an electrode in the brain. But the spikes, like the student up there said, are all or none events, whereas the field potentials are these sum synaptic potentials that occur across the dendrites of neurons. But a neuron contributes to the field potential in its summed postsynaptic potentials. A neuron contributes to a spike via the action potentials that travel down its soma and axon. Is there any kind of a relationship between them? One thing we can do is every time a spike happens, we look at what happened on the LFP or the EKG. The LFP and EKG, again, are just different versions of field potentials. ECOG from the surface of the scalp and LFP from the tip of your depth electrode. If we take a snippet in our field potential or ECOG of every time a spike occurs and do that for every single spike, we can then see at what phase of the field potential and at what frequency the spikes entrain to. So like I said before, if you're in deep sleep or anesthetized, your brain kind of defaults into this oscillatory network. The book chapter I assigned you from Buzaki's book, that book in the whole is a very challenging read. It takes you, I read it by committing myself to reading 10 pages a day for a month, and I got through it. But that's what it takes sometimes. But it's a very good introduction if you really want to dive into this stuff of oscillations and the nature of neural signals, the nature of how coding occurs in the brain as you listen to me. So what we can see here, like I said before, that when you're anesthetized, you have the whole brain's in kind of this slow oscillatory rhythm. Can anybody just look at these traces and tell me what's going on? Are the spikes doing anything special? Sorry? Is there anything regular about them? It's firing in clusters. That's true. You can see that in the most part, they're firing two to three at a time. And they appear to be firing at the troughs of the field potentials. So what we do is, you know, we take the spikes, we take the snippet of the LFP and the ECOG, and we average them. And this is called a spike-triggered average, because you're averaging the LFPs and the ECOGs on the occurrences of the spikes. Because there are many techniques that you can use to ask a variety of questions about brain function, which we're starting to discuss now. We will go into more detail. So what you can see is that there appears to be, now since we're averaging, we're in effect low-pass filtering our signal, you can see that there appears to be a phase lock at about the 1 to 2 hertz component of the field potential in ECOG. If you listen to this in a real experiment, what you'd hear is, whereas if you're listening in an awake behaving experiment where the rat's doing its rat thing and thinking about what it's smelling, and also it's hungry and its brain's doing so many computations, it sounds like random noise to you. But in an anesthetized, where everything in the brain is pretty much entrained, at least in the neocortex, everything in the brain is entrained to this kind of slow rhythm, you get, you know, this very nice, very easy to see entrainment. And to tell you the truth, this seems to make sense, right? I wasn't here for Chris's lecture. I was up north on my honeymoon. So I was doing my own thing, as it were. Well, with another person. Now here, if we look, if we're sticking an electrode in the brain, does someone remember anything about the initiation of action potentials? What causes an action potential to go off? I'm sorry? That's right. That starts the spike initiation. So, if we have little nerve as a little squid axon, or our cockroach axon, or our pyramidal cell and mammalian neurocortex. Right, I'm recording the intracellular voltage. Now, this is an experiment that's being done right now at universities across the country as people try to understand what local field potentials do. If I wanted to mess with you guys, I would put on the exam, what do LFPs do? And the one who'd get the right answer would be like, we do not know yet. So imagine if I stick two coils. Let's make the coil over here. And I change the extracellular recording potential via these two stimulating wires such that I'm oscillating the extracellular voltage between, just for grins, let's just say, you know, plus 100 and minus 100. Then I take my little recording electrode here. What do I think I'm going to see as I oscillate the extracellular field? What am I going to see in my spike in my intracellular recording? That's right. Since, you know, there's this notion of a threshold, of an all-or-none event in the initiation of a spike. You know, I think it's got to be, I always get the polarities backwards, so excuse me. Because, you know, extracellular is opposite of intracellular, so. We have our little holding potential, and we raise it to 20. All of a sudden, we're going to see the spike happen. So if I'm modifying the extracellular potential like this, perhaps I would see something like firing in phase with the depths of the field potential. Because by modifying the extracellular voltage, you are in turn modifying the intracellular voltage, and you can cause the neuron to fire. And, of course, in this experiment, I am not sticking two stimulating electrodes in the brain. The brain is oscillating on its own, and when the oscillations reach the lowest voltage extracellularly, which translates into the most positive voltage intracellularly, you get spiking, which is why you see the entrainment to the field potential in this case. Easy to understand. Okay, now let's go to an experiment where the rat was actually doing something. This is the rat when he's awake. And so here you see the rasters. Here you see the LFPs and EcoGs. And the rat in this case was trained to put its nose in an aperture, do something which we're not going to worry about, stick its nose out in order to get a food pellet. Now, as I said in the first couple slides, about how if I stick an electrode on your scalp, on the surface of your forehead or skull, I can tell a certain number of things. Now, this is anesthetized signal, and this is awake rat doing its rat thing signal. Now, what looks different? A lot more activity. It looks a lot noisier. It looks a lot more random. You don't see this very perfect entrainment. I mean, it kind of makes sense. In an anesthetized brain, the brain's not doing anything. So you should be able to represent its dynamics with just, okay, I'm going to have every spike fire at every 2 hertz. But that doesn't really encode that much information, right? If you can reduce the state of the system to, like, one equation, right? That is not, you know, that doesn't provide enough information for us to do all the wonderful things we do. But how do you characterize this? You have all these kind of high-frequency components going on here. The phase locking looks a little weird. You know, it looks like it's phase locking a little bit at 8 hertz. The spikes seem to be modulating. So you can see that there is a quietening of the individual spikes, then an increase as the rat was preparing to exit its nose out of the aperture. So in this case, we're in the motor cortex, and it's encoding movement. So you see a modulation of spike rate discharge, you know, as the rat was exiting. But I want to hit the point home that when you start doing awake behaving recordings, then it gets a lot more complicated. You know, you have, if you think about, you know, if you decided to record from my brain and asked me to make a movement, sure, you might see responses to certain arm movements, say in this direction or that direction. But maybe thinking about what I want to eat for lunch, I may smell a cookie that reminds me of my childhood. I may be doing mental arithmetic in my head. The brain is doing all these things that when you're just sticking one electrode, or even 64 electrodes, or even 10,000, the brain itself has 100 billion electrodes, all cells all doing something. And we are literally in the dark ages when it comes to neuroscience. We find ourselves very, you know, sophisticated that, you know, some of the most advanced labs in the world can record 1,000 cells at a time. But again, the brain itself contains 10,000 neurons per cubic millimeter of tissue. So it'll be a long way away from understanding neural encoding. My dad's a physician, and he hates the brain, understandably so, because the treatments that you can get for neuroscience afflictions are not very sophisticated, to say the least. Also considering that 1 in 3 Americans, or 1 in 3 worldwide, are affected by nerve system illness, or will be at some point in their lives. The reason is that it's just so hard to understand when you have this huge population of cells all modulating their electrical signals, all in a complex network of neurotransmitter release and habituation, adaptation, all the wonderful things it does. It makes it very hard to treat. Whereas the heart is just a pump, right? Muscle is actuators, right? The brain is this fatty piece of tissue that conducts electricity in some mysterious way and allows us to do things, but also makes it so devilishly hard to understand. Here's research from another group at the University of Washington showing that when an animal makes an entrained movement, you can see such, again, the heterogeneity, but you do sometimes see ripples. So when a monkey was actively searching a puzzle box, you saw an increase in about these 20 hertz beta oscillations, which are movement evoked oscillations. And if you do your little data mining, you do your data selection, you're like, okay, I see this oscillation, I'm going to then only look at this epoch in time, do my spike-triggered average, and lo and behold, I see the phase locking at the 20 hertz. Which, again, makes sense. Anything that's causing a change in the extracellular potential should also cause a change in the intracellular potential. And then, what if our cells go away? One thing I'm going to talk about in the last lecture is the electrode problem. For neuroprosthetics and science fiction and the Matrix to become a reality, we need to be able to actually record brain signals for 5 to 10 years. I'm not an expert on cardiac research, but I think pacemakers last 5 to 10 years. Is that true? Does anybody know that? Cochlear implants, I think, last that long. Regardless, you lose the ability to do chronic recordings within 2 weeks to a year, depending on the prep, and if you're lucky, you're recording single units. But since the local field potential is recording from a wider array of neural populations, and you do not have to be so close to the nervous system signal source, if your electrode causes chronic damage to the tissue surrounding your electrode, you can still record your field potential. And you can still extract information from that. Here you can see it was a monkey trained on a 8-direction arm movement task, you know, back, forward, left, right, and then the diagonals. And if you do a spectrogram, and a spectrogram is an analysis of an analog signal in time and frequency, time on the X, frequency on the Y, you can see there is an increase in the high frequency ranges, and it appears to be tuned to certain movements in this direction. So there is information in the local field potentials granted you do the appropriate analysis to see it. So again, this is kind of an introduction to neural recording, and we'll do our experiment here soon. But we keep moving forward and trying to improve the technology. Gee, wireless would be nice, and also tethered cables with drug delivery and all that kind of thing. And that's what researchers around the country are trying to figure out. But let's see if we can get this to work. So right here we have our discoid cockroach. It's not the cockroach you see in your house. I used to have those, but they can fly, and they're really gross. These ones just look like giant roly-polies, so they tend not to freak me out or people I show this to out as well, because it's not going to fly away and, you know, infest the house. So what we do... Should I use the... Is there any way to, like show what I'm doing in this... What? Anybody want to help me? Anybody use these things before? I'm sorry? Doc cam? That would be pretty cool. Okay. White balance. Not that bright, but you get the idea. He's already donated one of his legs to science, so that's why you see. All right. There's his leg. So, if you wanted to do your own experiment in neuroscience, it typically costs about $40,000. But if you only want one channel, you can use this. It's called SpikerBox. And so you could do recordings at your own home. I think I probably am the first person in probably 50 years to do my own recordings in my home workshop, depending on your... personality. You may think that's cool or really weird. Or both. So I'm putting a reference in the part of the... Oh, okay, sure. Well, that's pretty dope. Sweet. Alright. Now, another reason cockroaches are not much like us is that they do not have myelinated axons. Now, myelinated axons allow you to increase your conduction velocity, but one way you can work around that is just by having big axons, and that's what squids have, and that's what insects have. And right now, I'm picking an electrode, so hopefully, if I turn it on, I'm recording from a nerve inside here, and you'll be able to hear the spikes. Looks like it's working. All right. Anybody hear that? What does it sound like? It sounds like noise, but it's not. I believe. How could I tell? How could I? How do I determine whether it's noise or not? If I can drive the activity. So, one way. Some of the neurons are dying. That's why they're going so fast. That's really fast firing rate. So, right? What you're hearing, you know, if we look, well, you can't see it. But if you look, you know, you can see on your leg there's all these barbs, right? Little hairs. And one of the reasons cockroaches are so fast is that they can detect wind direction on these barbs, which are transducers that then synapse with the nerves, you know, to the leg and to the ganglia. Insects don't really have brains. So, what happens if I blow on the leg? What do you think is going to happen? What happened? The noise increased. It's not noise. All right. So it's portable, and you can listen to it on the go in your car. I have done that. I have driven down Liberty Street with this playing out of my car stereo. But, you know, this is cool because we're now listening to spikes in this classroom. But we're all engineers and scientists. We've got to be able to record data. So hearing popcorn through a speaker is okay, but wouldn't we like to be able to actually see the signal? So, you may not know it, but the sound card on your laptop is actually a fairly good data acquisition device. It samples, the microphone input samples at 96K. Typical neuroscience samples at 40K, so this is more than enough. So let's see if we can record. So, laptop. All right. So it's not connected to anything. We don't see anything. But what if we plug it into this thing? Maybe we can look at the waveforms. There you go. That's what it looks like. So let's see when I blow on it. Yeah, blowing on cockroach legs. A lot of fun. So what did we discover here? What did I just show you for the that we talked about? Rate coding. I don't have enough control. If I had a machine to blow air at different wind velocities and I blew it on this leg, what you would see is What I drew here is the stimulus rate coding. That as the stimulus increases, the discharge increases to a certain level. Now, what are we seeing here? Now, again, the noise is very low for neural recordings because it's a cockroach. It's just got it going on. It's 340 million years. And they have big, giant nerves because they don't have myelin, so the voltage is larger. Compared, this is a millivolt, whereas in humans, this wouldn't work in a human because it's, you know, 100 volt, microvolts. So that's why I can use off-the-shelf components to do this. But looking at this, what do we see? Are we recording from one cell? Why not? Yes, so you can see there's many different elements in here. You see these high amplitude spikes. You see these kind of middle amplitude spikes. There's low level stuff here, which may or may not be noise. Here's the noise floor. So what we can do, and what we'll go move on to when we talk about data analysis at the next lecture, is if you take this, how can you then extract this into single neurons and do your analysis of choice? So that's all I have to talk about today. Feel free to play with these things as more as you want. And I know I don't have notes like typical your previous lecture may have, but when I give a review session, I'll make sure that you'll have something that you can use to study for. So, note importante.